Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hello, everyone, and welcome to CeraBoost, the Happiness Science Insights podcast produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We're champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I'm your host, Lu Ngo, coming to your ears from NARM, Melbourne, Australia. Let's learn together. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to CeraBoost. Today, we have a very fun topic. It's going to be full of big words and lots of interesting facts. And we have a very special guest with us today as well. We're going to talk about consciousness, unity, and interplay. And in our virtual studio today, we have Paul Thagard with us. Paul is a philosopher, cognitive scientist, and author of many interdisciplinary books. He is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at the University of Waterloo, where he founded and directed the Cognitive Science Program. Thank you so much for joining us today, Paul. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting time to talk about our topic today. And before we go into the topic, I'm really curious about your professional journey because, you know, you are the author of many books. You've done so much work in this field. And before we started the conversation, you also said you're working on another book, which sounds really fun to me. So I wonder, you know, what's the background of this journey? You know, why did you start this journey and why are you so passionate about this topic?
Well, I got interested in philosophy when I was in high school, mostly because I was rebelling against religion. And so I went on to do a PhD in philosophy. But shortly after I got my PhD, I discovered there was a really fascinating field called cognitive science. This is an interdisciplinary field that combines psychology and neuroscience and computer modeling. And so I really got interested in that. So for the last many decades, I've been doing both philosophical problems, but also taking a perspective that comes from psychology and neuroscience and building computer models.
That's fascinating because I think it's like a very diverse background that you have there and, you know, lots of different areas of interest.
Well, you need to have that combination. If you're interested in how the mind works, and we all are because we've got minds and they have to navigate through the world, you need to combine ideas from lots of different fields, not just ideas, but also methods. And so I try to do things that involve philosophical reasoning, but also things that involve computer modeling and working with psychologists. So if you want to know how your mind works, you have to take ideas from lots of different fields.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think that's why we're going to have a really fun discussion today, because it'll be a lot of new learnings for myself as well as our audience. Especially, yeah, I love that you asked earlier, who are your audience? And I think like for a lot of people that follow our shows are young people who are probably millennials. And, you know, these kinds of learnings are not something that we talk about, you know, on the daily with our friends or circles. So we'll learn a lot from you today. I'm sure of that. Before we go into the topic, we have a section called Have You Met Paul? So we'll get some recommendations from you about some different things that you might like. So you don't have to think too hard. Just, you know, the first thing that pop into your mind. My first question is, what is a book you would recommend?
Well, the ones I'm excited about are always the ones I'm writing now, but it's going to be a couple of years before the consciousness book comes out. But I've got a book coming out early next year on misinformation. So I got very concerned about all the misinformation that was spreading over COVID and climate change and political conspiracies. So that'll be out roughly in January or February. So I hope people will have a look at that. So if you're interested in why lies are so prominent in the current world today on social media and lots of other things, I think that book will probably interest people quite a lot.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. Thank you. I love that you're talking about a book that you're authoring, you know, because sometimes we get recommendations about books that people like, but it's even more fun when our guests share what they're working on, especially because, you know, you're a wealth of knowledge. So definitely, I'm interested to find out more about that book. And I agree, there's been a lot of misinformation in the past few years. And I think
it's time for us to all educate ourselves. I feel like it's kind of, it's not the exact same, but I find that it's probably similar to a book that I read a couple of years ago called Factfulness. You know, it's also about, you know, things that we think to be true, but they are actually not. You know, part of that is because of information. Part of that is because of biases that we all have. So yeah, I'm interested to read your upcoming book as well when it comes out. So I'll subscribe to whatever newsletters you have to learn more about it.
That's great. The subtitle, which gives a pretty good idea of what it's about, is Why Misinformation Spreads and How to Stop It. And so you need both those things. So this is where psychology is really important. So one of the main reasons why people are so prone to misinformation is called motivated reasoning. That is, instead of evaluating a claim about your health or climate change or politics based on the evidence, what people often do is just go with what suits their goals. You are motivated to believe something, and so you don't do the proper evaluation based on evidence. So I think the book has a good account of both how that happens, as it does in all of these areas, but also some good advice about how to provide self-defense against being sucked into the misinformation that's floating around the world today.
Yeah, wonderful. I'm excited to read that book. Now, second question, what is a movie that you would recommend?
Boy, I've seen a lot of good movies lately. One of the ones that I've liked the best, which is done by a Canadian director, it was called Women Talking by Sandra Pauley. And it's based on a novel. And it's actually an amazing study of a group of Mennonite women who are in a community where there had been systematic rapes. And they have to talk about how they're going to deal with the men who were responsible for it. So that's one of the best movies I've seen recently.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a dark topic, but at the same time...
It's very dark, but it also gives real insight into human problems.
Yeah, it must have been profound as well. And it's probably not an easy watch, but something that we should watch at the same time.
But it's very engaging. It's not in the least boring. You see the women talking about how they're going to deal with this in the context of their religious views. And I found it utterly fascinating.
Yeah. Must be a lot of learning and eye-opening too. Thank you for that recommendation. I'll definitely put that on my watch list. All right, next question. You're our podcast guest today, but which podcast would you recommend to our audience?
I've done a lot of podcasts recently, but I can't remember the names of them. So I don't have a specific named podcast that I could recommend.
Yeah. What kind of topics do you listen to the most?
Well, actually, I rarely listen to podcasts. I read a lot of books. I love books. So I'm much more into reading than listening. It's basically because I'm a very fast reader and a very slow listener.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I could understand that.
I'd rather sit down with a book that I can go through very rapidly than listen to people talking.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. Next question. Who is your role model? Now, this could be a famous person or just someone in your circle, your personal role model.
I think when I started off in philosophy when I was in high school, it was inspired by a book by Bertrand Russell called Why I Am Not a Christian. And so I proceeded to read many, many books by Bertrand Russell. So I guess in my very early days, he was my role model.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Final question. What is a course you've completed that left a really strong impact on you?
Well, my courses were a long way past. That's many decades ago. But when I was in graduate school, I took a course on the history of science. And one of the things we read in it was Darwin's book on the origin of species. But when I looked at it, it was from a historical perspective, but also I was really interested in the kinds of reasoning that Darwin did. So I ended up writing a big paper for it that became part of my dissertation. And so that course probably had the biggest impact in my graduate career.
Yeah, wow. Fascinating. It must have been so many years ago and you still remember insights from that. So it must be a really great course. Thank you for sharing. Alrighty, now we are going to move on to the main part of this conversation. We're going to talk about consciousness, unity, and interplay in the context of happiness. And I ask all of my guests a question, the first question. Every time I ask this question, I get a different response. So I wonder what your response would be. Paul, how do you define happiness?
Well, I don't believe in definitions. It's actually a misunderstanding of concepts to think that they should be out, have the kinds of strict, necessary, and sufficient conditions that amount to a definition. So I never give definitions. But what I try to do instead is, first of all, give examples. We've got lots of examples we can understand of happiness. I'm happy when my favorite sports team is winning. I'm happy when I'm reading a really great novel. The best novel I've read recently is called The Covenant of Water by Verghese, and it's just an incredibly rich novel, and that certainly made me happy, even though there are lots of sad events in it. So those are examples. But then you can also look at the typical features of happiness. And here, I want to take a scientific term. I think that because happiness is an emotion, and emotions are things that go on in the brain. So it's brain activities. But it's a very complicated kind of brain activity because it's not just simple kinds of neurons firing, although that's part of it. What I think emotions are is they combine what's going on in our bodies with evaluations that we make of the situation. So when you're feeling happy, your body changes. I mean, there are things like your heart rate goes faster, your blood pressure may be lower. So there's bodily changes, but that's not enough to do it. But we're also making judgments. So happiness involves making a judgment or an evaluation that things are going well. So that when I felt happy after reading that book, I thought, wow, my goal of reading good books is definitely being working. So what your brain is doing is tying together a bunch of signals that it's getting from your body with signals about the evaluation of your current situation. And when you put those two things together and the evaluation is positive, your goals are being accomplished, that's when you're happy. Mm-hmm. So yeah. This isn't a definition, it's a theoretical claim about this is what happiness is. It's what's going on in your brain when you're combining certain kinds of bodily changes with certain kinds of evaluations that your goals are being met.
Yeah, I think it's probably the best thing that you started with today when you talked about examples rather than a definition. Because, you know, I've had many guests on the show and each guest has their own way to define happiness in lives. But I think it's a really different approach when you say, like my sports team's winning, that makes me happy. Reading this novel makes me happy. Those are little things in life. And, you know, in fact, I read something the other day. Actually, I saw, a post on social media about happiness. And I think that's really similar to what you just talked about, because it's like an accumulation of little things that you love in life that bring you joy, that bring you happiness, rather than a big definition of, I only see happiness as this like big event that happens or like this big thing that makes me happy. In fact, it's not. Our lives would be much happier when we notice the little things and we enjoy the little things in life. Like you just said, those little things come together, add to your level of happiness. I think that's beautiful.
Well, you want to have lots of examples, but if you're taking a theoretical perspective on this, you also want to have explanations of what's going on in our brains when we're happy. And that, I think, involves these two kinds of brain activities, both the detection of bodily changes, but also your evaluations. So the next question is, well, how are you doing evaluations? Where do our goals from? And I've got a whole theory of that, too. I published in 2010 a book called The Brain and the Meaning of Life. And that has a theory of what our fundamental goals are and should be. So I can put it to you in a slogan. I've got a lot more deeper theory than this, but the slogan is, the meaning of life is love, work, and play. So I think if you've got happiness connected with love, happiness connected with work, and happiness connected with play, then you can be a happy person. Because these are, I think, the three major sources for happiness in people's lives.
Yeah. Definitely. I love that. Thank you for sharing. So I'm sure that in the context of your work, especially because you said you had a few books that touched on different areas of this, you probably have, either interviewed people or look at data or talk to a lot of people in your lives in general. And you probably noticed that sometimes people see happiness in the wrong way, perhaps, at least compared to the way that you would see happiness. So what are some of the biggest misconceptions about happiness that you notice that people have?
Well, probably the biggest misconception that people have in our society, I presume that Australia is the same as Canada and the United States on this, is that people think happiness is money. I just came across a great quote in The Covenant of Water, this book I was plotting, where one of the characters said, success isn't money, success is doing what you love. Because a lot of people think that the key goal in life is just to accumulate money because that will make them happy. But that's just got it all wrong, because money is useful for doing things, like letting you travel and obviously eat and get shelter and things like that. But the idea that you think money should be the source of happiness. I once heard of a high-tech billionaire who said, you know, I used to think I'd be happy if I had $1 billion, but now I realize it would take $8 billion. Well, this is insane, because nobody needs $1 billion. If you've got a good life, that is, you've got one that's rich in love, work, and play, then you can be perfectly happy as long as you've got enough money to satisfy your physical needs, things like food and shelter. That's obviously important too. But once your basic physical needs are taken care of, then the psychological needs kick in, and that those, I think, are summed up by love, work, and play.
Yeah, I think that's so true, because the other day I was listening to this audiobook, and it's called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. So it's basically about a therapist and her therapist, and she was talking about her patients, and in one of the patients actually decided to I believe quit a corporate job and decided to be a cashier at Walmart, because she really loved interacting with people. You know, she just really loved to, you know, talk to people, checking out and make, you know, conversations and make people happy. And initially the therapist was kind of shocked, because she was like, why would you want to do that? But then, you know, the patient actually ended up doing that herself, and she was really happy about it. And the therapist actually ran into this patient when she was checking out Walmart herself, and she could really see how happy her patient was, because that's truly what she wanted to do. And I think that's similar to what you're talking about. You know, it doesn't matter how much money we're earning, as long as we're happy with the work that we're doing. It brings meaning to us in our own way, because we all see work really differently and we enjoy different aspects of life. So yeah, I think that's really fascinating, and totally agree with you.
There's lots of psychological data on this. People don't get happier and happier the richer they are. Obviously, you need enough money so that you can eat and have reasonable shelter and things like that. But there's lots of evidence that what matters to people is sometimes called relatedness or belonging. That is, connections with other people. And it sounds like your Walmart clerk was getting the kinds of connections with people that she wasn't getting from whatever kind of job she had. So we need to have these kinds of connections with people, ranging from romantic love, but also lots of other things, of family connections, friendships. And in this case, I guess she was happy with the casual kinds of connections. So that relatedness, which I put all under the heading of love, because friendships are counted there too, is just absolutely fundamentally important to human beings in a way in which accumulating large amounts of money isn't.
Yeah. Definitely. I totally agree with that. And I really love the definition, and, you know, like the misconception you pointed out as well, because I think when I talk to people, or, you know, when I read things on the internet, it's clear that we don't appreciate the little things as much, and we don't really look inward and see what we enjoy to kind of, you know, bring that into our lives, bring that into our work. And today we're talking about consciousness. I'm probably going to think, you know, my mind's kind of going, okay, this might be correlated to today's topic, because, you know, it has to do with consciousness, awareness, and so much more. So let's talk about that. I know you mentioned this earlier. You wrote a whole book on consciousness, I believe. So it might be
I'm working on it now.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, you're working on the book now. Sorry, you have so many books, and I'm like, okay, you're working on this one now. So you're working on this one now, and I think you said it'll take a few years before it comes out, which means there'll be a lot of work that goes into it. But here's a big question: what is consciousness?
Okay, well, sounds like you're asking for a definition, and I told you I don't like definitions, because no one ever succeeds in giving good ones. And certainly no one has managed to give a good definition of consciousness. But let's go back to examples. I can give you lots of examples of consciousness.
Let's do that.
So when you're seeing something, you're conscious of it. You're aware of what you're seeing, all the senses, what you hear, what you touch, or what you feel. But there are also internal senses. When you're in pain, or when if your stomach's rumbling, or you've got an itch, those are all kinds of internal sensations. But another great category of examples of consciousness is emotions. There are hundreds of different emotions. And every day people feel them, like happy or sad, or feeling lonely or feeling jubilant. And so there are lots of these that are examples. And the fourth kind of consciousness examples is very abstract ones, like being self-aware. So right now you're having all these visual, auditory, emotional experiences, but you're also probably thinking about, well, how am I doing? You can be aware of yourself as experiencing all these things. So there's a whole set there of a large number of examples. But then you want to ask, what's the typical features of that, of consciousness? And there, awareness is a big part of it. It's not just something that's happening to you. You're actually experiencing it. And so the kind of awareness experience is among the typical features. The third thing you want to ask about a concept is, what explains it? What's the theoretical basis for it? And here, cognitive science hasn't done very well because there's been a lot of theories of consciousness proposed, but frankly, I don't think they're very good, which is why I'm inspired to produce my own. And so that's what I'm doing with the book that I've now written about half of the first draft. So my theory of consciousness is that it basically depends on a small number of brain mechanisms. So I think of consciousness as something happens in a brain. Not everyone believes that. I mean, if you're religious and you think that you're going to survive your death, well, you think that consciousness goes on without your body. But I don't see any evidence for that. So I've got a theory of what goes on in the brain when people and a few and some other animals are conscious.
I think it's a lot to process right now, because you said it's not a definition that you would bring a lot of, it's actually a lot of different examples. So now my brain's kind of consciously processing all this information and trying to understand and make sense of it. So in today's topic, we obviously are talking about, two more things besides consciousness, which are unity and interplay, which are also sort of big words in my opinion, because, you know, everyday people, we probably don't talk about these things very often. So I wonder if you could sort of make a connection there. And also you mentioned the awareness of the physical world earlier. So I wonder how would that impact our daily experiences?
Well, the unity is really important because our consciousness isn't all wildly unconnected. I mean, sometimes in dreams you find this, or people who do a lot of drugs might have unconnected consciousness. But normally, our consciousness has a lot of unity. So right now, when I'm looking at the computer screen, I'm not seeing just a bunch of disconnected things. I see the computer screen, but I also see the picture of you. But I'm not seeing you as just a bundle of headphones and hair and glasses and your face. No, it's actually all a unified picture. And so part of the theory of consciousness is to say where this unity comes from. I can answer that by telling you what I think are the two initial mechanisms for consciousness, what the brain does. The first one's called neural representation. So your brain's got about 86 billion neurons, and they're all firing all the time, but with different patterns. So you have to have different patterns to capture what a jacket looks like, or what hair looks like, or what glasses look like. And so you've got different neural firings to do that. But to get unity, you need another mechanism called binding. Binding is where you get to put together these different things into something. So that your jacket, for example, isn't just a bunch of unconnected things. It's got color, it's got shape, it's being worn. And so you put that all together. And so the unity is largely the result of this mechanism of binding that operates in our brains that takes things that might seem to be unconnected, but then you put them together into a coherent whole.
Okay, so I think what you just said was interesting to me in the sense that, you know, we're constantly making sense of the world around us. And it's true that when I see you, same thing, you know, it's not like I just see a person sitting there with headphones and, you know, your surrounding, but I see the unity in that, like as in I see Paul, who I'm talking to, and that's your environment. And it's interesting in the sense that, you know, we don't really pay attention to the way we see the world a lot of the times, I guess, because it's just like, oh yeah, like this is how I see things. And so I find that, you know, when it comes to our physical world every day, when we see things, I wonder if, and this is like totally not on the agenda, but I'm curious, I wonder if we see things differently, because obviously, you know, like I think we are going to see things slightly differently, you know, like the way that I, you know, perceive this surrounding that I'm in right now might be completely different from somebody else who's in the same environment. And so I wonder what your thoughts on that are, and, you know, what are some of the factors that might impact our, you know, way of our consciousness and how we view things and the unity of things around us.
Well, you're right that there are lots of things that make for differences. We live in different countries with different cultural backgrounds, different whole history of experiences. But on the other hand, we actually have a lot in common, because our brains work pretty much the same way, because we're all humans. And our senses work pretty much the same way, including our eyes and our ears. And there's even evidence that our emotions work pretty much the same way. There's even there's differences in emotions across different cultures, but there's also lots of overlap. And so our history and our culture makes for differences in our consciousness. But because we've got basically the same kind of brain, because we all descended from the same 10,000 people in Africa about a few million years ago, we've got the same genetic basis for our senses as well. And so I think there's also lots of commonality in people's consciousness as well that we shouldn't underestimate.
Yeah, that's very true. I think it's a matter of, you know, interpretation too, because, and also you mentioned emotions, and I find that to be one aspect that I myself, when I think about how I view things, it's very important. And why I'm saying this is because I think relating to personal experience, when, you know, I'm going through emotions that are, you know, like sort of like on the positive side, I see things very differently from when, you know, like I'm going through like these tough emotions or like turmoil or, you know, depression and things like that. And I feel like this might apply to others, you know, not sure about other people, but for me personally, when I go through a tough time, even the brightest places seem gray. And, you know, my consciousness perceives like this environment, this, you know, that's like, you know, these happy people as something that is just so like hard to kind of perceive, and just, it's just sad. And it's like, it's even like annoying even. So it's kind of like, it depends on my emotions too, which is why I think it's important to touch on a little bit of self-reflection, because, you know, when we self-reflect on how we're going with our emotions, how we're going with our physical health, mental health, we can probably see and understand our consciousness better. At least that's the way that I, you know, understood my consciousness better, because I knew that, yeah, like the sky is blue, everyone's happy, but I wasn't happy with that simply because of what I was going through. And, you know, that was like the way that I was self-reflecting. So what do you think the role of self-reflection is in enhancing the understanding of our consciousness?
Yeah, that's really important, because you got to think about yourself as experiencing the emotions, not thinking of the emotions as just something that happens to you. And you're certainly right that everyone over a lifetime goes through lots of different changes. If you've gone through a romantic breakup or you've lost a family member, these things are really sad and they're going to have a big impact on you, and they are going to change how you see everything else. On the other hand, if you've just recently fallen in love or just gotten a great job, then that's going to provide a positive coloring for those other things. But there, tying it in with the self is really useful, because you can think about yourself and realize that everyone has some good times in their lives and some bad times in their lives, and that's going to be responsible for a lot of the different kinds of ways you see the world emotionally at those different times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true. I think it takes a lot of self-work as well to start to realize these things, because, you know, a few years ago, I never thought about these things at all. I never really thought, oh, you know, like my emotions or what I'm going through will change my, you know, level of consciousness or the way that I view the world around me. But then now I know that it's not true. And in fact, you know, like exactly what you just said earlier. And I think we could all benefit from this particular aspect, because when it comes to understanding ourselves better, we see the world differently. And sometimes we would also be able to understand that it's not, and this is about like interaction with other people. It's not about what they are doing, perhaps it's about what you're going through. And you know, like maybe you're annoyed at someone who's really nice because you're just having a bad time. And you know, it has nothing to do with them and everything to do with how you're feeling. So it has a lot to do with self-reflection. But there's
lots of things you can do to increase that. I mean, one is read really good novels, not crappy novels, but really, really reflective novels, literary novels. There's actually evidence that reading literary novels with rich characters and plots increases people's empathy. So a major way we understand other people is through empathy. So that's one way to do it. And for people who are having problems, if they're suffering, for example, from anxiety and depression, a really valuable thing to do is to go to a psychotherapist. Psychotherapists are trained to help people reach these levels of self-reflections. And there are lots of good ones, and they really can help people do that. But my preferred way to do this is to read literary novels.
Yeah. That's a really good point. Yeah, I heard someone said that as well when it comes to, you know, the different kinds of books that people read and, you know, what it can bring. Because sometimes a lot of people are saying, you know, like the only books I read would be nonfiction, you know, like just self-development books. But in fact, you know, reading fiction or, you know, novels in general would actually curate our empathy. And I think that's super important. But one thing that we touched on earlier related to this topic was, you know, when we talked about self-awareness and understanding our own selves, right? And I mentioned this to you. So I wonder how you think about this. Because, you know, when it comes to our understanding of ourselves, when we have our self-awareness, we have a sense of self, we would be more conscious in our interactions with other, and we can kind of catch ourselves when we're having the tendency to judge or misinterpret or, you know, just see things in the wrong lens perhaps. So how does our sense of self influence our interactions with others in general?
Well, a crucial part of interactions with others is empathy. So empathy is putting yourself in somebody else's shoes. And it's really a kind of analogy, because suppose you've got somebody and you can't figure out what's going on in their lives, but then you realize that there's something similar in their lives to something you've experienced. You can remember back to what you experienced and think, oh, maybe they're feeling something like that. So you can't just look at somebody and know what their emotions are. But if you do this kind of analogy and see a comparison between where they're at now and where you were at in a similar situation, then you can feel how you felt, and then you can transfer that feeling over to them. This is called empathy, and it's just really crucial for understanding other people. It's really crucial for morality, for acting well, because you want to put yourself in someone else's shoes, realize what they're going through, and then try to think, well, how would I feel? And then that gives you the kind of moral reaction that you need to think, oh, that's just wrong. So that if you've got a bunch of refugees who are sleeping in the streets, you can imagine, well, how would I feel if I were just new to the country and forced to sleep in the streets? You'd realize you'd feel really horrible. And so you should be motivated by outrage and this kind of empathy to do something about it, to go and try to get politicians to change the way the refugees are treated so that the moral outrage stops.
Totally. I think what's interesting, though, I feel like there would be caveats to this and, you know, lots of nuances, because I think our sense of empathy would vary from person to person and, you know, from circumstance to circumstance. And why I'm saying this is because an example that I would give is probably, you know, someone who can, let's say, empathize with refugees who seem to have this like great level of understanding and can, you know, feel for what the refugees are going through, might not necessarily feel the empathy towards a loved one who's going through a hard time. Now, I'm giving this example because, you know, this is exactly what I've seen, you know, in my life in the past few months. And I find that to be fascinating because it's the same person, but then the level of empathy they display towards people they don't know is greater than the empathy they display towards people that they know. And I find that to be interesting and fascinating in the context of, you know, like consciousness and unity, because when we're talking about, if we're talking about unity, you know, based on your definition earlier and based on what I understand, it's the same person, right? Like, but then their level of empathy just vary. So, you know, I would love for you to help us to make sense of that and also understand how we can cultivate a greater sense of unity in our life to and connectedness with other people.
What would be an example of a case where someone feels lots of empathy for refugees, but doesn't care about their friends or their romantic partners? I think there's going to be other things going on there, because if someone's capable of having empathy for refugees, then they should have the possibility of seeing it for their friends too, unless there's something that's somehow blocking it. And sometimes when people get into really close interpersonal relationships, there are other issues that go on, but there's anger or resentments of different sort. And so I think that there's probably something special to the situation and emotions that are operating there that are blocking the empathy, which the person is clearly capable of. But of course, there are people who are not capable of empathy at all. They're called psychopaths. And there are psychopaths, they're about 1% of the population, who don't care about anything except themselves. And so they never put themselves in somebody else's situation. And these are people to, first of all, avoid personally, and second, don't elect into political office.
Yeah, that's a really good point you raised there. Definitely, there must be so much that goes on, you know, when it comes to the circumstance and things like that. And because I think this is like, it comes from my personal experience and, you know, people I interact with. And this is, in fact, not just one person, but multiple people that, you know, have displayed this in, you know, people that I know, you know, in circles. And I find that it's good that you highlighted the fact that a lot of factors might be at play, because sometimes this is what I hear a lot, like, you know, when it comes to, let's just say, a family, a mom might criticize their son. Oh, you care so much about your work. Why don't you care as much about me, for example, or empathize with what I'm going through? You empathize with your colleagues, but not me. I hear this every now and again. And, I, you know, like, I think this is where it gets really interesting, because it's a human element into what we're discussing. Each person is very different. The circumstance is different. And it takes so much to, you know, not only understand ourselves, but also kind of try to understand and make sense of what others are going through. And this kind of, it brings in a lot of interaction and understanding. And obviously empathy is a big factor of it. But yeah, I think it's like something that we all have to navigate as humans. And it's good to hear from your perspective, having done so much work in this area. So thank you, Paul, for the insights earlier. Now, we have a few more questions on the same topic, but I'm conscious of time. So I would love to hear from your perspective to kind of share any of the insights that we might not have time to cover yet, especially when it comes to, you know, the concept of unity. So we touched on that briefly, but I would love to hear about how you think the relationship between that and well-being would be, you know, and our satisfaction in life. Also, you know, we're living in, you know, this day and age where social media is such a big part in our lives. And also, you know, we live in a society, we don't just live by ourselves. So there are a lot of different factors here that we might not have the time to cover yet. So before we move on, I would love for you to share anything that we might have not covered yet.
Well, going back to your unity theme, normally I emphasize that there's lots of ways in which our consciousness is unified and that our consciousness forms a coherent whole. But of course, sometimes that unity breaks down. One example is in dreams. Dreams can be extremely chaotic and hard to figure out because you seem like one person and then you're in a different place or a different place. So dreams aren't terribly unified. But in other ways in which you can break unity down is by drugs. If you take LSD, you could have a whole bunch of experiences, of sensory experiences that just don't fit together. And so that indicates just how sensibly tuned our brain has to be in order for unity to be accomplished. Another way in which unity breaks down is mental illness. If people are schizophrenic, then their dopamine neurons just don't work properly, and so they can't make a coherent whole. Their life becomes just really, really confusing. And so the unity of consciousness is a feature of it, but it's one that really needs to be appreciated because sometimes it breaks down in very unfortunate ways.
Yeah,
so we want to explain both the unity, which by brain mechanisms like binding and coherence do very well, but we also have to understand the ways in which through mental illness or drugs or dreams, we lose that kind of unity and just what goes wrong when we do that. I mean, some people think that dreams, which is a major topic in my current book on consciousness, are some great sources of insight. I don't think they are at all. I think they're basically just a side effect of what goes on when we're sleeping, which is mostly memory consolidation. So rather than thinking that dreams are some great insight, as lots of people have from various religions or even philosophy, I think they're basically just these side effects that screw up the unity of our brains. And so we shouldn't take our dreams seriously at all, because they're kind of disunity of consciousness rather than the coherent, bound up kinds of consciousness that I think are much more valuable and actually more typical.
Yeah, that's an interesting insight. So that's on consciousness and unity. But what about, you know, the impact of social media in our lives?
I frankly don't use social media very much. I mean, I'm on Facebook and I'm on LinkedIn, but I just don't use them very much. You know, it's probably a question of age. I communicate with my friends largely through email. My sons, who are in their early 30s, they obviously think that email is comparable to dial-up telephones, which, but I think there's loads of evidence, especially under young people, as people are in their teens, that social media can have horrible effects. People who are spending all their time on Facebook or Instagram, and they're constantly engaging in social comparisons, and it's not communication, and it's not making people feel good. And so I think that makes it really bad. I mean, the best kind of communication, obviously, is face-to-face, where you get far more information than you get from a text or even from a video. So those things are okay if you can't face, but face-to-face communication is extremely rich from the point of view of consciousness, because you get all the different senses working, you get all the kinds of emotional communication that can come from facial expressions and body language. You get empathy going much, much more. So I think that the interconnectedness of people, the interplay of people, really benefits enormously from these kinds of personal interactions. Whereas when people are spending all their time on Instagram or on TikTok, I've read recently that young people are spending hours every day on TikTok. And I frankly, I don't understand why, but it's a major part of the interactions that people are doing. But they're really missing a lot. They're really missing a lot of the fundamental kinds of emotional communication that are crucial for establishing the relationships that are well established to be really important for human happiness. So I think there's just lots of evidence, and many people have been saying this, that social media are making people unhappy. It's partly because of comparisons. Everyone seems to be richer or better looking than you are, but it's also just doing that rather than having the kinds of human interconnections which really do enable us to be related in the richest ways that actually support happiness rather than distracting from it.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a factor of it, because I don't understand TikTok either. I'm of the younger generation compared to your generation, but I agree with you on that front. I actually don't know. I don't use TikTok at all. But I guess, you know, it's kind of something that will take a lot of studies as to, like, because these companies, they design their products in a way that would, you know, let people just get sucked in, and just they are not able to get out of it if they don't have a certain level of consciousness, which is right back to the topic that we're talking about, right? Because I think sometimes they just go with the flow and they are not conscious of the fact that hours have gone by.
Right. Well, for this you need actually my fourth mechanism of consciousness. I already talked about neural representation. I talked about binding to make and coherence. The fourth one is competition. So a big part of consciousness is there are a lot of things that are competing for consciousness. Consciousness is very limited. I said your brain's got these 86 billion neurons, and they're doing all sorts of different things. Almost none of that is conscious. Almost everything your brain does is unconscious. Typically, people can only keep in mind maybe half a dozen things at once. And so there's a competition going on. And the people who designed TikTok created an algorithm which is absolutely brilliant at moving quickly on to something else that sucks people in. So their consciousness never gets away from TikTok, which is, of course, what TikTok wants, because they got ads. They're trying to sell you stuff. And so TikTok has managed to create a competition algorithm there that makes people want to keep on watching. instead of doing all the things that are so much better for them, like reading a book or talking to a friend or going for a walk. Mm. Right? There's just all these other things that provide happiness in much deeper ways than watching one little video after another and wondering where the last 2 hours went.
Yeah. I think it goes straight back to our consciousness of how we're spending our time and how much that adds to our level of happiness. Because I feel like sometimes people are just, you know, going with the flow and doing all these things because they're so used to it. Oh yeah, like, you know, I have a few minutes and actually I have 30 minutes. Let me just sit here and scroll TikTok or Instagram. It's much easier than, oh, I have 30 minutes. Let's go for a walk. Because that's probably a foreign concept and they don't realize it themselves that, you know, they are spending their time this way.
Going for a walk in a forest incredibly good for people's well-being. There's lots of data on that. Whereas spending 2 hours on TikTok, especially if it involves things like social comparisons, where you're seeing all these people who are more rich and beautiful. I mean, that just makes people feel bad. And so there's just so many better ways for people to make them feel better than to engage in these kind of abstract social comparisons.
Yeah. So the big question here would be, how can we integrate our individual, you know, consciousness into a collective effort for positive change? Because, you know, clearly something is not going right with, you know, the use of social media, which is just one of the many issues that we have in our society nowadays. So, you know, how can we do this as a society where we all integrate our individual consciousness into a collective effort for positive change?
Well, it's absolutely crucial. Look at climate change. I don't know what the situation is where you are, but Canada has been having its worst wildfire season ever. There's thousands and thousands of wildfires going on in British Columbia and Ontario. And it's happening because of climate change. Because of climate change, the air is hotter and drier. And so the trees in our huge forests are just on fire. So there's been smoke spreading all around North America as a result of this. There's been firefighters dying. But the big issue there is climate change. So I give a concrete example of what you're talking about. How do you get people concerned about climate change, which is causing a huge threat to humanity, as opposed to what the coolest new toy is or what the best dance moves are? A lot of it, I think, has to depend on human interactions. And so if people are interacting with each other and caring about each other and reading books that help them to care about each other, then that I think there's a possibility of changing this. But right now, all the evidence coming out is that climate change is accelerating faster than the scientists are predicting, which is going to be absolutely horrendous for sea level rise, for wildfires, for floods. All these things are really disastrous. And so it's really crucial that people, especially young people, because that's the future, are concerned about this. Now, of course, there has been some cases of what's happening. A Swedish woman whose name I can't remember got lots of people organized in schools. And so she's just actually had a wonderful effect on lots of young people in various places. So there need to be more movements like that so that people are spending their time and energy dealing with these major threats we have to the planet right now, rather than the petty distraction that you get from social media.
Yeah, I think it's a big factor as well, because when it comes to social media versus dealing with and really paying attention to social issues, I think a big factor of that is running away, you know, like that escape that you get from, you know, just seeing these short videos compared to actually putting time and effort into understanding what's going on in the world, especially if they already go through some things in their lives and they need a quick escape. They would probably not think about, okay, let's you know, look at climate change. I would just rather spend some time and relax by, you know, watching these videos. I think a lot of factors are at play. I'm not completely discounting the fun things that social media can bring. For example, my friends sometimes send me cat videos and that makes me happy. but it doesn't mean that I'll spend 3 hours watching cat videos. It's a balance that we all need to find. And I think it has to do a lot with our consciousness, right? Because we need to be conscious of how we're spending our time, what we're doing. And sometimes we need a little bit of an escape or, you know, just fun things to add these elements into our lives. But yeah, I think starting to talk about it and starting to do a bit of self-audit of, as to how we're spending our time would probably help, you know, as a start, because we always need to start somewhere and start small would be a good idea.
Well, the great thing about self-consciousness is you can move up to a higher level. Instead of just being tied up with the emotions of the moment or the sensory experiences of the moment, you can step back and think, what kind of person do I want to be? That is, how do I want my life to be better based on goals like love, work, and play, which includes not just concern with yourself, but for other people. And so this is where that branch of philosophy called ethics is really valuable, because you can have ethical principles that say, don't just concern yourself. That's egoism. That's not ethics. It's think of all the ways in which you can make other people's lives better. And actually, there's evidence that when people do that, when they dedicate themselves to caring for other people, they end up happier as well. Evidence shows that one of the best ways to make yourself happy is to stop thinking about making yourself happy and do what you can to improve the lives of other people. A good side effect of that tends to be that you're a happier person because you've established relations, you've done good things for other people. Your life has gotten better, their lives have gotten better, and way better than if you were just concerned about your own minor internal goals.
Yeah, definitely. That's a really good point to wrap this part up. Thank you for that. And now let's talk about something a bit more practical. You know, let's talk about a practice or a habit that, you know, you can share with our audience, because we've covered very big topics. As I said, these are really big topics that we don't talk about very often. So to get a bit more practical, what is a practice that you personally do or you would recommend to our audience to enhance our consciousness and maintain the unity that we've been mentioning throughout this podcast?
Well, I could give you an example that's really small. Would you like a really small example? So
yeah.
I have an Apple Watch, which I use for all sorts of purposes, especially for exercise. But I also use it for meditation. And so it's got an application called mindfulness. That's sort of a pretentious name for controlled breathing. But about a year ago, I started using it about three times a day. So meditation isn't anything mystical. It's just something that really controls your brain by controlling your breathing. And so what I do three times a day is I use the mindfulness app on my Apple Watch and just control my breathing for 5 minutes. And I really like it. I mean, it's incredibly, basically it's calming, because if you're spending 5 minutes thinking about your breathing, you're not thinking about all the things that are difficult, like all the bills you have to pay or whether you should go to the dentist. Or basically, you're just concentrating on your breathing. So meditation is nothing mystical. It's a kind of technique for calming your brain by paying attention to your breathing. And so I really like that my Apple Watch makes it easier to do because it's got this mindfulness app built into it. So that's just a really simple way to calm yourself, reduce your anxiety, pay attention to something other than what's been worrying you. So that's a really small example, but I've already mentioned lots of bigger examples like spending time with your friends, reading really good books, or if you've got serious problems, seeing a therapist.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think those are all really practical insights. And, you know, as we mentioned earlier, start small and, you know, build that up. I think the meditation practice is really good. And I do that every day. I think it's super helpful.
Yeah.
I cannot really think of a time before meditation anymore. It was a foreign thing for me. But once I started going into it, I was like, this is really good. Like it really got me to think. And at the same time, it got me to feel much better afterwards. So yeah, couldn't agree more. And a lot of the guests on this show for different aspects of happiness also suggest the same practice. It's amazing how one practice can, you know, help with multiple aspects of our lives. Okay, so now let's go into open mic. As I mentioned to you earlier, we have open mic where we would like to invite you to talk about anything you're passionate about. We've talked about consciousness quite a bit, but I wouldn't be surprised if you want to talk about it some more, especially since you're working on a book on this particular topic. The floor is all yours. Go for it, Paul.
Okay. Well, we get down to something specific. The chapter I've just been writing right now is on musical consciousness. And if lots of people have music in their lives, I'd count that as part of play. If you're a musician, then it could be part of work. But for most of us, it's just kind of play. And for me, I listen to music about 8 hours a day because I always have music on when I'm reading or writing or doing domestic chores. So music is a big part of consciousness for many of us. And so the trick is to figure out, well, how does it work? And I made a breakthrough last week that I guess I want to tell you about. It has to do with the binding. So you start with music as just being consisting of notes, which are pitches, different kinds of frequencies that hit your ear and make your brain have representations in a certain way. But a pitch by itself isn't music. If you put a bunch of pitches together, then you get a chord, which sounds even better. And so that's handled by the kind of binding I was talking about before, where you take the neural representations and you kind of work them together at the same time. But when I was working on this chapter, I realized I had a big problem because I didn't know how to talk about melody, because a melody isn't a pitch happening at the same time. It's something that involves a whole series of pitches. And how do you bind those together? I thought, oh my God, I need a theory of timing. How am I going to find a theory of timing? Well, it turns out that my colleague, Chris Eliasmith, who's incredibly brilliant, has a new theory of timing that I think works really well for music. And so you basically have to think of our memory as something like a conveyor belt, sort of what you get when you in an airport, then your luggage comes out and your luggage gets carried around. Well, the conveyor belt has different segments on it, and the different segments can carry different pieces of luggage along. So here I'm taking this profound mathematical idea of Chris's and turning it into a simple analogy. But it works really well for thinking about how melody works, because you've got your memory that carries along like a conveyor belt, but it's got things on it, like suitcases. But what's on it isn't suitcases in your memory for music. It's, in fact, complex neural representations that combine the pitch and the timbre and the loudness of the sound that all gets bundled together, and then it gets attached to this conveyor belt in a way that you can move it forward or move back. And so my big excitement for last week was this idea that timing is something that the brain can do, because in Chris's theory, this all gets translated not into conveyor belt metaphors, but into neural processes. We get an idea of how the brain manages to have this sequence of events, and it can plug sounds into it in a way that produces melody and rhythm and all the wonderful things that make for great songs. So this was my exciting discovery last week.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I'm really excited to learn more about this book when it comes out, and definitely read it as well. So thank you so much for sharing that. It's certainly a topic that is different from what we talked about earlier, especially when it comes to music, because I'm sure everyone, or most people, love music. And, you know, to understand this in a more scientific way of its connection with consciousness is really cool. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. So Paul, thank you for joining our show today. And before we let you go, I would love to ask you to share a bit more about, you know, how our audience can find out about your work. Perhaps you have a website that people can go to and, you know, maybe get a subscription to find out when the books get released, or, you know, ways to connect with you for a collaboration.
Yes, there's two main ways people can find more about my work. My website is paulthagar.com, and it's got loads of information about my different books and about many articles as well. So number one is the website, paulthagar.com. Number two, for people who don't want to read my articles or books, because some of them are kind of technical, I do a blog for Psychology Today. And so my blog for Psychology Today has got more than 160 short, relatively simple pieces that deals with questions like consciousness and emotions. And the difference is that whereas a lot of my published work is aimed at an academic audience, this is meant for ordinary people. And so that's for most people, that's probably the best place to start. If you just Google blog Paul Thagard, you'll find my Psychology Today one, and you'll see lots of different sorts of things being discussed.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that. And thank you so much for being here as well. It's been a really fascinating conversation, very different from the regular topics that I get to talk about, and quite tough to process as well, you know. It'll give us a lot of food for thoughts later, especially for myself. I'm not sure about our audience, but for myself, I'll probably have to listen to it again and really reanalyze what you shared, because there's quite a bit of information there. So thank you for
thank
that.
Thank you for all the interesting questions.
You have been listening to Sarah Boost, the Happiness Science Insights podcast produced by the Happiness Science Labs, a division of LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. More episodes are available from 10 Life Management Perspectives and can be found by searching LMSL on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and other podcasting apps available on your devices. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, share, and subscribe to our channel so that other people can find it and we can continue to provide quality content. More of our work can be found on our website, ha.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Lu Ngo. Thanks for tuning in.